Donald Trump is long gone history, right? He lost the election, got banned off all major social media websites, and even Fox News seemed to have turned away from him, focusing instead on COVID denialism and being, well, being Fox News. All the Twitter users with blue check marks seem to be almost out of work since the task of filling up his comment section with tweets about how terrible he is being null and void now that he's banished to the exiles of his Florida golf courses. The big bad bully is gone once and for all, right? And now everyone can go back to brunch. Or maybe not. You see, I predict, in my humble, always correct political opinion, that Trump's legacy and impact will be on par with that of Thatcher's or Reagan's in the worst ways possible. I don't think he was a glitch in the system of liberal democracy, nor was he a simple symptom of liberal democracy or the centre-left projects preceding him that failed to control the economic sphere. That criticism of liberal democracy is of course valid and can involve a whole podcast episode in itself, but we must remember that the Trump project was not just a cynical individual pulling off the mask of our current political structures, but our political structures doing exactly what they were designed to do: sustain power and control. Trump was not just a consequence of political apathy, but a design project pushed forward by the alt-right and likes of Stephen Bannon, who wanted to see their fascistic society materialized. And they got very close to that. Closer than I think a lot of us would like to admit they did. Whilst COVID-19 has torn out the foundations of our political structures, introducing state power we thought died in the 70s, and reigniting political protests we thought were a 60s fever dream, and while it will definitely mark the start of this decade, we cannot ignore the years that preceded before it. In those 5 or 6 years, the likes of Trump and far-right projects across the world mobilized to an extent no one thought was possible, and notions of normality in politics became as absurd as a Camus novella. Unfortunately for all of us, however, fake news, mainstream media, the woke mob, culture wars, and dangerous Chinese communism seem to be sticking with us for a lot longer than Trump's presidency. But welcome to the propaganda machine. It is your host, Mohammed Hassan, and yes, I would like to first of all apologize for my hiatus, but thank you to all of the really motivating messages that I've gotten. I've had a bunch of exams. They were my final school exams that I had to do before I hopefully go to university next year, and of course that kind of took priority to this internet podcast that I do in my bedroom. But that done with and dealt with, today we look at Trump, his rise to power, the movement of populism that preceded him and why it's important to analyze it, how a symbol of the far right ignited dangerous movements across the world and normalized them, which is an important element we must be very aware of, and how we shouldn't be quick to forget Big Bad Orange Man. So before we get into Trump's actual presidency and his impact and legacy after it, we should look at the years of political events that preceded it, that came before Trump, and how the rise of populism and the financial crash of 2008, that I seem to talk about in every single podcast episode at this point about politics, is very important to understand. You see, in 2008, this sort of liberal democracy, free market capitalism came crashing down, as suddenly the state had to intervene to massive extents to not help the people, but instead bail out the banks, which was in a very important part, because that bailing out of the banks, whether it was necessary to prevent an entire collapse of capitalism or not, that people sort of wanted to or didn't want to, gave rise to populism becoming very, and no pun intended, very popular. Why? Because populism, as defined by Google, and once I tell you the definition, become very aware why I'm talking about it, is the political approach that strives to appeal to ordinary people who feel that their concerns are disregarded by established elite groups. And from 2008 to 2013-14, this feeling of being disenfranchised and ignored by the elites was not helped by austerity politics and the massive slashing and continual slashing and privatization of much of the public sphere. I mean, this had been going on since the Thatcher and Reagan years, but That economic system had collapsed in 2008 and had given opportunity to an entirely different system of production and government intervention in the economic sphere being available to us now. But instead of doing that, those in power bailed out the corporations, bailed out the banks. They've done the same thing in 2020, and that caused a lot of discontent. Because while people were losing their homes, losing their mortgages, losing their jobs, they turned to the obvious place where everyone turns to in a crisis, the government. And instead of the government being there to support them, here in the UK, we had austerity measures. We had universal credit that slashed the benefits of those people in the most vulnerable positions. And this gave rise and was a perfect environment for populist projects to rise. Now, I know we're going to be talking about right-wing populism, but left-wing populism also became popular and is still a bit popular today, because the Occupy movement came out of that 2008 financial crash, where we had Occupy Wall Street, we had Occupy the financial sector here in the UK, where we were asking for the government to bring back that public ownership and accountability of the economic sphere to the people, democratizing the economic area. But right-wing populism has been far more successful, particularly in the West. Now, we can talk about the reasons why left-wing populism didn't necessarily succeed, but the fact is that the likes of Trump, Bolsonaro, Boris Johnson, Viktor Orban, Modi across the world show us, and even Le Pen, the fact that she didn't win isn't necessarily important. The fact that she got to almost winning is important because it shows us that right-wing populism spread on a massive global scale. And people may see this as a sort of natural reaction to the politics preceding it, but people like Steve Bannon were instrumental to that sort of proliferation of right-wing populism across Europe and the Americas. Now, right-wing populism and populism itself can be understood as working on these sort of lines. There's four key elements to populism that Ben Stanley, who is a political theorist, articulates. That being the existence of two homogenous units of analysis, that being the people and then the antagonists, who are the elite. Again, the antagonist relationship between these two units, so they are working against each other. This notion of a popular sovereignty, the will of the people, because of course populism is aimed at the average person in a certain area. And also, very importantly, which gives us a nice segue into the next segment, the positive valorization of the people and the denigration of the elite. Now, for Trump, this is his entire political project and especially his campaigning. See, Trump was most successful when he was on the media, when he was going in his campaign tours, because he was able to use those four key elements of populism and absolutely compound onto them. Particularly the last one, the positive valorization of the people and the denigration of the elite. All of Trump's campaigns were literally him talking about how amazing the MAGA cult was, how amazing the Patriots were, and how they were going to fight the elite, the establishment, the Washington politics, the political careerists of his time. Which ultimately led to the insurrection, because that's what happens when you keep on stoking conflicts between two antagonistic groups. You end up getting a massive climax of violence and conflict. But it's important to understand that populism did not just occur out of nowhere, right? It was, of course, caused by the material conditions, but the right-wing populism we see today was pushed forward by a bunch of think tanks, individuals, and billionaires like the Koch brothers that pushed for these things forward. The Bannon Project and what was essentially the repainting of fascism and conservatism, in air quotes, as the new counterculture to this political correct consensus that they claimed had gone mad. If anyone was on the internet in the early 2010s, particularly places like YouTube, you could see how they became feeding grounds for conservative pundits and mediums and the rise of dogmatic idiots like Ben Shapiro, Steven Crowder, Milo Yiannopoulos, and Katie Hopkins on sites like Twitter and YouTube made social media in the early 2010s an absolute hellscape of what was essentially kind of just Nazis everywhere. And it's not to say that left-wing representation was good either. We, of course, had the Tumblr years that sort of set back leftist movements very far. But this is significant to the rise of Trump because he used these social media platforms. I mean, Trump was, of course, very, very open about all his views, like an idiot, on Twitter. And he was going viral almost every single day. And his campaign and the push of, that he had of himself did not use the traditional media in the past sense of, you know, pandering to the sort of media or the sort of, you know, newspapers here in the UK. He used the viral nature of social media in order to get the attention of those traditional media and make sure he was being spoke about in all of these sectors. Now, in order to use the viral nature of the social media platforms, he, of course, had to also build off of the antagonisms that were going on there. And anyone who has been on 2016 YouTube knows that there was this massive anti-SJW sort of push or this sort of movement in which the alt-right, which was just a cover-up for Nazism, which was, of course, exposed by the sort of 2017 Charlottesville protests. But even articles like BuzzFeed exposed that the likes of people like Milo Yiannopoulos being in contact with people like Steve Bannon, who were instrumental to the campaigning and management of Trump, particularly in his during the election period and the early years of his presidency, and self-admittedly used the same anti-social justice warrior imagery in their fight against this image of the fake news mainstream media. So this sort of anti-SJW sort of nonsense, essentially, that was being peddled in the 2010s on sort of the social media platforms was the same populist antagonistic sort of rhetoric and symbols that were being used by Trump and the media personnel in his own campaign. I mean, the examples of this being things like the refugee crisis, right? These things were caused by Western powers intervening in the Middle East. But instead of having a conversation about foreign policy and what she was doing, it became a conversation that was rampant with racism, Islamophobia, and white supremacy. I mean, Syria and the Libyan military crises could have been solved without any of those things being involved, but this right-wing populism had been pushed to such an extent, and that was the sort of antagonistic rhetoric that they were being used, and that was being used, that it became almost impossible to have conversations about these things without some crazy Nazi coming in with a white genocide or white replacement conspiracy theory. Because all of these things, these conditions, were used by these people like Steve Bannon to mainstream white supremacy and fascism. The financial crisis, of course, which was caused by a capitalist system that prioritizes profit over the people, was not being questioned for its fundamental issues, like how can we change the relationship to production in order for these things to be prevented. Instead, we were speaking about how immigrants were overusing our houses or overusing the NHS and how we don't have enough money for all these brown people that are flooding our borders, even though Britain didn't even take in the most refugees, and in fact doesn't take the most refugees. And in 2020, numbers went down by 27%, even though for like all of April and May and June last year, it seemed as if these people couldn't stop talking about refugees and this refugee crisis that we were having, that the media also stoked. The right-wing populism used all of these sort of conditions and forced those antagonisms into the mainstream that allowed people like Trump to present themselves as the savior of the average person. Which is, again, an incredibly stupid thing, because the hypocrisy of right-wing populism is that people like Trump, who is a billionaire, has definitely been a part of the establishment and is a part of the establishment. You don't be a billionaire without being part of the economic elite. I mean, you're the definition of the economic elite. He's voted for both Republicans and Democrats depending on who could benefit him, not on who would benefit the average American patriot. And it's not just Trump. Again, this is a global project. People like Nigel Farage, who is a banker, who has worked in London in the financial sector and in the media. He goes around to migrant facilities in a fucking Rolls Royce claiming to be a patriot for the white working class. Boris Johnson is just a rich prick. He's an Etonian who went to Oxford. He is the definition of establishment politics. The only reason he is in the position he is in because of where he was born. If he was not born to the family he was born to, did not go to the schools he went to, did not get into Oxford and then became a part of the media circles that he became a part of, he would not have been able to become the Asda version of Donald Trump that he is. I mean, even Viktor Orban, right, who is extremely far right, is basically a neo-fascist, went to Oxford University. These people who tote themselves as fighting against the establishment are part of the very establishment they claim to be against. And they were able to peddle these lies because the material conditions, right? The financial crisis, systemic racism, the terrorism and instability of our societies were perverted into these antagonistic lines based on things like race and culture and patriotism and nationalism versus political correctness, instead of actually talking about the fundamental issues. And it's important to understand that because there is responsibility on both sides. Of course, the right-wing populists like Steve Bannon perverted these conversations and utilized these conditions to their benefit in order to stay powerful. But similarly, the media and even left-wing critical theorists were too busy writing books that were incredibly hard to fucking read and just like completely inaccessible to the average person. Meant that we were being ignored or not even viewed at when we could have possibly given answers in return to this. Now, in the past couple of years, I'd say that sort of, that's 2 or 3 years during Trump's presidency, left-wing theory has sort of become more accessible and now everyone's a fucking communist, it seems at times. But we could have prevented these things with being more open instead of being stuck writing academic papers on why a certain movie shows how capitalism is inside all our minds. Of course, theory is important, but if you see the difference between left-wing theorists and how they present themselves and how the right-wing manifests and projects their theories into the media, they came at us with quick, easy sound bites. I mean, it was so easy for them to just blame everything on political correctness and the woke mob. They didn't have to care about definitions of what certain things were. While it sometimes it seems that on the left wing, particularly the populist section, or those who aim to sort of be in the theoretical section at least, seem to be talking about esoteric and nonsensical things that can be very important, but it's the manner in which we present these things. See, that was the difference between why right-wing populism and the Bannon Project succeeded, because they were able to manipulate the media. Now, of course, they already had media control. As I said, these were people who were part of the established politics, right? Boris Johnson is part of the establishment. Nigel Farage, part of the establishment. They had those connections and links, but they also utilized things like social media, which also funded by billionaires, and again shows the asymmetry in power and the hypocrisy of the right wing to claim that they were ever being silenced, for example, which in fact brought me over to the left wing. In fact, that's a little personal anecdote there, that the reason why I never really bought into right wing stuff was because they were constantly shouting about how they were being silenced. And the reason why I didn't believe them was because I could hear that they were being silenced. I mean, if people are being silenced and their stuff is being, censored, for example, you don't hear about it, because the whole point of silencing and censoring is that nobody hears about it. Again, the hypocrisy of right-wing populism. But the problem was is that they were able to present this hypocrisy as common sense against the woke mob or this abstract political correct establishment that they were a part of. And the reason why I focus on Trump specifically is because Trump is an amazing example of the state system that is meant to have checks and balances, that is meant to work against each other to enforce some form of accountability. being far more of a facade and being far more susceptible to take over by authoritarianism than we think. See, within my 2 years of studying government and politics that paralleled and coincided with Trump's presidency, it was very easy to see the difference between the textbook theories and theoretical frameworks that these political systems should be working on and the actual real-world mess that it was. You see, instead of the Senate or the House working as checks and balances, it was media controversies that were taking place over policy issues and debate. Culture wars were used to stoke up distractions while millions of people starved and became homeless. Lying no longer became a joke where people would be economic with the truth or try to spin it a little bit. It became expected and we were thrust into this sort of post-truth era. Now, I'm skeptical of these sort of claims of the denigration of politics. For example, the Iraq war happened before that and politics wasn't very good either, but it was this weird paradox in which you could no longer really look at the world and say that it followed a sort of political theory or there was some sort of accountability at all or just truth anywhere that you could find out. And the liars just seemed to keep on getting away with it. I mean, right now, the Conservative government that has definitely worked on populist right-wing attitudes, the flag-shagging, the sort of patriotism, this sort of a disagreement with the woke mob and the way in which Priti Patel claims that there's, you know, the woke mob and a cancel culture are coming to, you know, destroy us, which is why she needs this authoritarian political bill to be passed to protect us from the sort of cancel culture. The way in which Gavin Williamson will champion free speech in universities, but then also pass forward bills that prevent anti-capitalist education, is again all imagery of this sort of Trumpian politics. I mean, Trump normalized this. We have to understand that this came from Trump's normalization and his ability to get away with it consistently because there were no political structures to prevent such lying from occurring. The guy got impeached twice and got away with it twice. Do you know how insane that is? And it's not like the impeachments were based on falsities. It's because the systems themselves were not being used properly. They were all facades. The parliamentary system of an opposition doesn't work when we have people like Keir Starmer in and parliamentary sovereignty in which Boris Johnson just needs a fucking majority to get away with everything he wants to do. Trump ushered in this cynical, populistic politics that is destroying not only our countries, but the rhetoric and the discourse around all these things. No one can talk about the NHS or about helping working class people without getting involved in some sort of esoteric nonsense about the woke mob. And again, this is of course a bit to blame on both sides, but we have to be aware of these things. The reason why I'm talking about this is because the very conversations we're having right now, the very sort of discourse that's going on right now about things like Israel and Palestine, where we can't get past the point where it's very obvious that criticisms of Israel are not anti-Semitic and that not anyone who supports Palestine is of course going to also support Hamas. And just because there are some bad people in a political group doesn't mean that the political movement behind it is bad. The reason why we're getting caught up in all these tiny, teeny, just distracting things is because that's the sort of politics that preceded us. We're still living in that Trumpian era where the discourse, the rhetoric is all about this culture war bullshit. And Trump was just a manifestation of that to its utmost extreme, and that's why his legacy is absolutely terrible for us. Politics under Trump became a PR campaign where we would be fighting for our teams and whoever labels we fucking assigned ourselves, instead of trying to do what was best for the country at the time. See, politics should be the realm in which our ethical foundations intertwine with practical application. And we say we want to achieve X goal, freedom for all the people. Okay, what's freedom and what's the people? And then we enact that through infrastructure, through legislation, through education. But instead of doing those things, we were all stuck in media flurry about Trump's fucking tweets while he was packing the courts so that for the next 20 years, we had conservative judges that were just putting more people into the prison industry complex. And while Boris Johnson gets away with fucking scandal after scandal after scandal, people are still focusing on Jeremy Corbyn losing. Yes, Jeremy Corbyn fucking lost. We have to deal with it. And I don't like Keir Starmer, but goddamn, if we keep on lamenting over fucking the fact that the media was against Jeremy Corbyn, we're not going to be able to actually hold the people who are in account right now, or who should be being held to account right now. And that's not what's happening. I mean, Dominic Cummings came out and just called everyone a liar, and the people were like, well, I don't know. That's literally what happened. There was no big action on it. Matt Hancock can lie about testing and just get away with it. I've seen the fucking Peter Stefanovic video on Twitter like millions of times now, and it's been watched by 20 million people. But that doesn't matter if the political structures that we have don't actually work. Trump, again, was the example of where the Electoral College system voted him in, not the American people. Again, showing how these systems were designed to maintain control at any cost, even if that means incorporating fascism and incorporating right-wing authoritarianism into our daily lives. And hundreds of thousands of people died because of it, not just through the wars that were continued, but because of COVID-19, right? These things were political. When New Zealand only has a couple of deaths, and the United Kingdom and the United States have close to millions of deaths combined, you can see that these are political choices. They weren't choices, they weren't things caused by population. They were caused by people systemically ignoring the issues that we have, and instead favoring conversations about culture wars that are just absolutely unimportant. And places like Twitter don't help it. And I try not to get in conversations on Twitter because they are terrible. But the point of today's podcast episode is to show you how these things come from historical conditions, how they can be perverted, how things like the 2008 financial crisis gave opportunity for not only change, but also to be perverted, and why we should be intelligent in our strategies and approaches to bringing out politics to everybody. The reason why I started this podcast was to act as a counteract, as a young black person, and a male specifically, to talk to people my age without all the bullshit rhetoric that is going on. To look at these political and philosophical issues and articulate them in a manner that is different to all of the distracting elements that we currently have. To talk about feminism and gender without SJWs being involved in the conversation, because that is what is important. It's important we look at these ethical and political issues and try to get at them foundationally, instead of being superficial or just virtue signaling. Instead of politics being a PR campaign, we should instead be focusing on moving away from Trump and that legacy of team politics, and looking at how can we solve the fundamental issues through organization and education. I am a firm believer in knowledge plus action. Learning about the conditions, learning the solution to those conditions, and then putting them into action. Now, I have been focusing a large part on the knowledge part, because as an individual, I am very limited in what I can do, and COVID-19 and my material wealth and conditions are of course not beneficial to that. But the excuses are unnecessary here. The main point is that we know what we need to do. Organize and educate. Now, of course, educating ourselves means that we have to collectively work together to ensure that we have those avenues of education. But it also means that we have to be patient. The revolution is not going to come in a day. It's not going to come in a weekend. Sometimes we have to vote for the likes of Keir Starmer compared to Boris Johnson, because the better of two evils is a thing that is actually very positive sometimes. Tony Blair was a fucking war criminal, but he was better than the conservative war criminals. Now, that's a sad state of affairs, but it means that in order to get past this sort of rhetoric and PR-driven politics, means we have to take some sacrifices, but also ensure that we are also organizing. That's why I'm involved in politics and philosophy, because if you want to help the world and make it a better place, you need to not only organize, but you need the knowledge on how to organize. And you not only need the knowledge and the critical theory, which the left is absolutely filled with, but that organization. You see, when I'm looking at the left and the right, this sort of analysis seems very prominent. On the left, you have a bunch of theorists and analysts who have amazing criticisms, but there is a strong lack of organization because A, working class people don't really have the financial means, but also academics who are left-wing don't really know what to do once they've written their dissertation on why capitalism is a terrible economic system. But on the right wing, you have stupid policies that are just funded by billionaires. So they don't have any knowledge, but they have all the power and material conditions in order to get those stupid policies that aren't based on any true notions except what people thought up in a think tank. And they are able to push that through because they're all billionaires. And that difference between the right and left is why we're sort of in this condition right now. And Trump is a prominent example of that. That we shouldn't ignore, but we should learn from. That we shouldn't emulate or repeat, but we can only do that by understanding how his legacy is currently impacting the discourse. How his normalization of certain politics has allowed for the COVID catastrophe to continue on today. The likes of Boris Johnson and the likes of those who are like him, like Orban, Modi, Bolsonaro, can be defeated if they are held to account and we continue to force pressure onto them. It may seem at times that apathy is the only thing that can be done, but we also need to think about radically changing our structures. We must, of course, utilize the current systems and push them to their extremes, which they are being right now. It means we also have to get involved in electoral politics. And sometimes turning away from the better of two evils is not always the best thing, because you have to vote for the better of two evils. But it also means that you can do that while also trying to organize a different radical politics. Utilize radical theory to enact radical changes. And if we can do that, then it seems as if our generation, which is the most forward and thinking and progressive of all the generations that preceded it, like every single one is, can maybe overcome that cycle of being the young, idealistic generation and then falling into the perpetual doomed cycle that every generation that preceded it does, and just being eaten up by the power systems. But that involves those two things. Knowledge and organization. And this podcast is kind of maybe the knowledge part, but the organization part is, of course, something we all have to get involved in. We have to be speaking. Yes, sometimes social media can be a facade and can be superficial, and I'm going to be talking about that in a future episode. But having those conversations on social media and changing the way we have those conversations, trying to be more in depth and try to look at the facts and the figures rather than just stupid made up slogans, it can be very beneficial, and pushing that out to the rest of the world is an important part. So Trump and cynical politics and his legacy is negative. I think we've sort of asserted that and sort of proven that over the past half an hour. But I always like to think of the positive out of that. And over the next few weeks, I'll be exploring alternatives to our current systems and what we can do. But that's for future episodes that are definitely going to come within the next month or so, hopefully. By the way, I hope that today you've learned how Donald Trump is not long gone history, how his legacy still impacts us, how the populist rhetoric maybe needs to be dropped and we need to pick another struggle and movement to favour. But with all of that said, thank you for listening to the Propaganda Machine. It has been your host, Mohammed Hassan, and I hope you guys stay educated, informed, and safe from COVID-19. So thank you guys for listening, and I'll see you guys next time.